from UALR Public Radio and the Argenta Arts Foundation. This is a Tales from the South Tin Roof Project.
The moment we got to the lake and began to unload the wagon, the scene resembled an Apache war party. Slingshots, Daisy air rifles, bows, arrows, mosquito spray, fishing worms.
Recorded in front of a live audience at Starving Artist Cafe in the Argenta Arts District of North Little Rock, Arkansas.
Then the food came in waves. Fried chicken, fish, butter bean, corn, okra, watermelon, pies, cakes, homemade peach ice cream, by the gallon, and more, grapette soda.
This week, it's an intimate dinner with a notable Southerner on our unrehearsed show, telling their story as if they were sitting on the porch with you.
I learned the importance of listening to elegant, moving stories with nuanced reflections told by the masters of their craft on our front porch.
So sit back, relax, and reconnect with the power of a story. Now, let's go live to Tales from the South.
A million times I love you daily. Mistreated you, my girl, and I'm sorry. Come back to me.
How's everybody doing tonight? So how about tonight's music by the Salty Dogs? Y'all like the Salty Dogs? Hailing from Little Rock, Arkansas, the Salty Dogs have shared the stage with Willie Nelson, and their music has been featured on the TLC Network hit show Trading Spaces. They have CDs for sale after the show, and more can be heard at thesaltydogs.net. All right, well, welcome to Starving Artist Cafe in the Argenta Arts District of North Little Rock, Arkansas, and to a very special edition of Tales from the South, a monthly series we call the Tin Roof Project, where well-known Southerners bring their own true stories to life. Tales from the South is presented by the Argenta Arts Foundation and Temenos Publishing Company, and tonight's show is sponsored by William F. Lehman Public Library, all right here in North Little Rock, Arkansas. And I'm your host, Paula Morell. On my left here, strumming his 1931 National Resonator, is blues guitarist Mark Simpson. Mark was a featured house guitarist at the late bluesman Junior Kimbrough's Juke Joint in Tullahoma, Mississippi. He wrote our theme music and plays for us live each week. And how about our set back here? Y'all like our set? These genuine screen doors from the Arkansas Delta with mixed media portraiture are by esteemed Arkansas artist V.L. Cox from her Images of the American South collection. A portion of the proceeds from the sale of these works goes to Tales from the South. More can be seen at her website, greatfineart.com. All right, are y'all ready for some Southern style storytelling? From Camden, Arkansas, David Hampton Pryor, arguably the most popular Arkansas politician of the modern era, held four different political offices during his career: State House of Representatives member, U.S. Congressman, Governor, and U.S. Senator. While in the Senate, he became chair of the Senate Special Committee on Aging and was a member of the Senate Agriculture Committee, the Senate Ethics Committee, and a member of the Senate Finance Committee, chairing the IRS Oversight Committee. Pryor's popularity with his colleagues was shown by his election to party leadership positions, including Secretary of the Democratic Conference, third in the Senate Democratic leadership. Late in his career, he became an active proponent for Bill Clinton's presidential campaign, and after Clinton won in 1992, an important liaison between the Senate and the White House. Since retiring from the Senate, Pryor became a Fulbright Distinguished Fellow of Law and Public Affairs, a lecturer in public policy at the Blair Center of the University of Arkansas in Fayetteville, and a fellow and subsequent director at the Institute of Politics at Harvard University's John F. Kennedy School of Government. Pryor has received an honorary doctorate of laws degree from the University of Arkansas and honorary doctorates from Lyon College, Henderson State University, and Hendricks College. He is past trustee of the William J. Clinton Presidential Foundation and served for 2 years as the first dean of the University of Arkansas Clinton School of Public Service. In 1999, the David and Barbara Pryor Center for Arkansas Oral and Visual History was created at the University of Arkansas at the urging of Senator Pryor and his wife Barbara, who have long had an interest in Arkansas history. The center has the mission to document the cultural heritage of Arkansans by collecting oral and moving image resources and to share those resources with scholars, students, and the public. In September 2008, his autobiography, A Pryor Commitment, was published, which chronicles his 4 decades of dedication to politics, government, and public service. Tonight, Senator David Pryor takes us down a dirt road and back to his childhood in 9 miles to Mustin Lake. Ladies and gentlemen, Senator David Pryor.
Camden, Arkansas is my hometown, as we call it. Born and raised there, 100 miles due south of where we gather tonight. My dad was elected sheriff of the county in 1938. My mother was the first woman in Arkansas to seek public office. Her race for circuit clerk, just as women had won the right to vote in the 1920s, needless to say, was not successful. During the 1940s, most of our summers were spent at one of the world's truly magical places, Mustin Lake. Few of you have ever heard about Mustin Lake. It was an old riverbed lake. They called it an old oxbow lake, perhaps a half mile in length and guarded by immense cypress trees. When school was out for the summer, my mother would load up the station wagon with the children, neighbors, dogs, fishing poles, bedding, and groceries, and a ton, after all, of grapeette soda, which was invented and bottled in Camden, Arkansas. For the radio audience who cannot see this, this is an original bottle of grapeette soda sent to me by someone even older than myself. And it was bottled, this bottle, particular one, I think was bottled in 1949 or 1950. Judge Vlines, if we could take this bottle of fermented grapeette, drop it on the Broadway Bridge, you wouldn't have any problems about blowing up the bridge. Preparations for this 9-mile ride out to Mustin Lake were akin to a trip to Outer Mongolia, and Susie Pryor was the undisputed organizer and leader of the opposition. The moment we got to the lake and began to unload the wagon, the scene resembled an Apache war party. Slingshots, Daisy air rifles, bows, arrows, mosquito spray, fishing worms. The final 5 miles to the lake house were all dust and sand. One year, someone had run over, they're still trying to figure out who it was, and killed a horse and then left the carcass on the roadside. And each time my mother drove us to the lake, she would pull up in front of Woolworth's store and we'd all race inside, buy the cheapest bottle of the cheapest perfume to douse on our handkerchiefs so that we could bear the stench as she gunned the station wagon past the dead horse. Terrible story. But for us, it was high drama and great romance. One spring, my mother had drawn up the plans for the lake house on a paper napkin and handed it off to Shorty Barron, a local carpenter. "Shorty, I'm going to Santa Fe for a month to get rid of my hay fever, and I'm counting on you to have our lake house built when I get back. Edgar will show you where to put it, and he'll write you a check. No contract, no estimates, no bid, just blind trust." My dad was the local Chevrolet dealer, and the lake house was built to accommodate large gatherings of customers, employees, and all others invited and uninvited. There was nothing intimate or classical about our lake house. There were three large rooms surrounded by screen porches, enough screen wire to go around the state of Texas, my dad would say. Our house was built on 8-foot pilings because the lake flooded in the spring when the Washita River overflowed its banks. Somebody called it a barn on stilts. A corrugated tin roof played thunderous music during the rains. Insulation? Air condition? Unheard of. There were 6 double beds in the living room, and the various porches boasted of wooden rockers and army cots with hard, musty mattresses. The roughly finished kitchen had a large sink, a linoleum-top table, and an iron, wood-burning stove in the corner. Our lake house was the gathering spot. Every day or two, a whole new crowd showed up as others left. It was a constant mix of humanity, excessive mountains of food, and the rich experience of just simply growing up. But the nights were best of all. By dark, the long shadows of the century-old cypress trees had faded. A hush came over the lake. The stars appeared over the trees, and the bullfrogs bellowed and croaked against the night sky. From our big front porch, you could sit there and hear a bass attack a minnow on the lily pad. A turtle would slide off of a log into the still dark water where real Indians surely had done their fishing and swimming centuries ago. Thad MacDonald and Colin Threadgill fished the lake at night, and we could hear a hoot whenever a lucky 13 or a dipsy doodle raised a big one. Paper plates were spread on long white tables on the east porch. Then the food came in waves: fried chicken, fish, butter bean, corn, okra, watermelon, pies, cakes, homemade peach ice cream by the gallon, and more grapette soda. On special evenings, on real special evenings, Hezekiah King would barbecue for the 20 or more people who had gathered at our lake house. All afternoon, he would have stood at the barbecue pit in the back, practicing his art in the middle of clouds of hickory smoke. After the supper tables were cleared, the floor swept and the lights dimmed, Hezekiah and his guitar transformed the big screen porch into grand theater. Hezekiah, Obadiah, Abraham Lincoln Jones. That was his signature finale, and after numerous encores, the magic time for storytelling on the porch took up when his songs and strumming left off. My mother then gathered the children in an intimate circle to weave her renowned tale of Old Weary Willie. And Lee Harrell would chime in with her famous rendition of Mrs. James Nebuchadnezzar Got Nothing, and then came tales of Old Camden, some of its funny, fascinating people. They even discussed Skidmore Willis, the county's lone Republican, and what he was up to these days. What a change. Others would have favorite heroes they had read about, ranging from Joe Lewis to Doc Blanchard and Glenn Davis, Fibber McGee and Molly, Johnny Mac Brown, even Fred Astaire, and guess who else? Clyde Smackover Scott, who was labeled by some as the world's fastest human being. On that porch, night after night, we were bonded, whoever we were, wherever they came from, into one family. Then it was time for bed. In the mad dash to see who could get the cot nearest the oscillating fan, we put unguentine on sunburned backs and Mother pulled the splinters from the bottoms of our feet and toes. It was then a special time, a very special time, to lie quietly and eavesdrop as the adults on the porch discussed the local sheriff's race, how the war was being fought, or President Roosevelt's health, or whose boy from the county wouldn't be coming home when the fighting was over. If anything scared us more than the polio epidemic, it was the fear of a Nazi invasion or a Japanese concentration camp. To the aroma of black coffee, Roy Tans, and the creaky whine of the old oscillating fan, we signed off on another day at Muston Lake. The night now belonged to the hoot owls, the crickets, and the lightning bugs. As the morning sun appeared over the lake, we would jump off of our cots, race down to the dock, and there was my mother in the middle of the lake, floating on her back, stretched out, reading a book. Her black wool bathing suit, one piece, of course, to gave sufficient covering just in case Preacher Valee from the Presbyterian Church was on the other bank snagging a perch. If it was Sunday, Mother would round up the children for Bible stories, and she made sure that no card games were played on the Sabbath. Then Mary took over. Her full name, Mary Elizabeth McFadden Cooper Hurd Wilburn. Mary had worked with our family since the day I was born, and she stayed with us for some 25 years. She would lead a small army of us down the lake a bit to Walker's boat dock. The rumor was that old Fred Walker had placed bales of hay under the dock, thus attracting multitudes of fish, and it was our favorite fishing place on the lake. Mary would put worms on the hooks for the most squeamish of her following, or she would roll bread rolls for those who didn't like worms. In her starched white dress, she had a communion with fish unlike any other human I've ever seen. She caught brim, perch, and bass that today would probably win national awards. And all that with a simple cane pole and a worm. "You've got to spit on your bait," she ordered. Sometimes she would snag a turtle. She also warned us, "But if a turtle ever bites you, children, he won't let go till it thunders." On Walker's Dock, with Gordon Newton, Sonny Harrell, Andy Pope Talton, and a cast of many others, Mary became not only our guide to catching fish, but a teacher in our relationships with people and nature. She was a fountain of basic wisdom, and she taught us about life. Should a sudden rain come, we would all huddle up under the roof of the boat dock. Story after story, Mary even told us about growing up in Louisiana during the Depression, and one winter living on absolutely nothing except walnuts. Our skin was never so shiny or more beautiful, Mary told us. Mother, among her many talents, was very adept with her Singer sewing machine. Once she found some brown satin material down at Watt's store, from which she made me a perfectly wonderful Tarzan suit. It looked so good and so much akin to the real Johnny Westmiller original that she gained her confidence and then sewed a Jane suit for my older sister Cornelia. And with a minuscule amount of leftover material, she produced a tiny wraparound for Cheetah the monkey. Cornelia and I would then pick out the most unsuspecting of the younger children to become Cheetah. Eleanor is Cheetah, and there she is. Eleanor was always the most agreeable of all the Pryors, and suddenly she was transformed and she hadn't gotten over it yet. We were the rage of Muston Lake. I remember those real special times when my dad would drive out of the Chevrolet place and come out to the lake house, drive out from town, and he would bring along the family Philco radio. On Friday nights, after an abundance of good food and good stories, then came the week's highlight, the Gillette Cavalcade of Sports. Our porch pulsated with each right hook and left jab. We were at ringside with Don Dumphy, and perhaps Rocky Graziano was defending the middleweight title in the middle of the ring. Some years ago, Barbara and I were in New York City. We were walking down the street with a friend of ours one night. This friend pointed to the front door of a nightclub nearby. Standing out in front, having a smoke, was an aging man dressed in a rather tattered old suit. He said, "Do you know who that man is over there?" our friend asked us. I said, "No." He said, "That's Rocky Graziano. He's the former middleweight champion of the world, and today he's that nightclub's bouncer." I went over to him with almost a sense of reverence. "Mr. Graziano, I just want you to know, sir, that you had a big fan club down at Muston Lake." He looked at me quizzically, kind of gave a little smile. He turned and shuffled off. Since those days long gone by, I have used the distance from Camden to Muston Lake as my mental gauge for 9 miles. Whenever someone says that a town or a point ahead is 9 miles away, I travel that road again in my own mind. When I was a child, that 9 miles seemed like a continent away. The funny thing is that this distance gets shorter all the time. I've spent the last years of my life trying to figure out just what it is that makes Muston Lake and the boyhood memories that I have from there are such a part of me. That special place is seared in my mind. I think about it. I dream about it. And only once or twice since a massive South Arkansas tornado ripped many of the ancient, majestic cypress trees from the earth have I been back to Muston Lake. Today, they say that the lake and the trees are beautiful. Maybe Muston Lake is special because it was there I learned how to swim. I learned how to bait a hook and even drive a car. But then I also remember the most important thing. I learned the importance of listening to elegant, moving stories with nuanced reflections told by the masters of their craft on our front porch. I learned to appreciate storytelling as a way of communicating with one another, an art which I fear is being lost. I guess to simply describe my feelings, Muston Lake was and is a special place where imagination soars and dreams had no boundaries. Someday before long, and I'm going to do this, I'm going to get my grandchildren in the car. I'm going to drive south on Highway 167 through Sheridan and Fordyce and Thornton and Bearden and Eagle Mills. And then I'm going to turn left and slowly make my way out to the old Muston Lake Road, wondering why that special world of yesterday on Walker's Dock and our big screened-in porch couldn't last forever. Thank you very much.
So thank you so much, Senator David Pryor, for being on our Tin Roof Project at Tales from the South.
One time I made a little talk in the United States Senate chamber, and someone had asked me what my favorite drink was. And I said, well, my favorite drink is Grapeette. Well, no one knew what Grapeette was, except the reading clerk in the Senate, who was at that time about 90 years old. And he came up to me and he says, I've got an old bottle of Grapeette out in my barn and I'm going to send it to you. And that's where that came from. Right?
I love the story of Mary Elizabeth McFadden Cooper Heard Wilburn taking y'all fishing. What were some of the other things Mary taught you about nature besides fishing that you can remember?
Well, for one thing, I tried to teach her and I failed. Mary could not drive, and my dad said to Mary one day, he says, Mary, my wife comes at 7 o'clock and picks you up, brings you here, takes you back at 7 at night or whenever it is, and she's wearing herself out, driving you back and forth. Mary, I will give you an automobile if you will just learn how to drive it. Well, that sounded pretty good. And so everybody got real excited about that. And so I got in this car that my dad was going to give to Mary Elizabeth McFadden Cooper Heard Wilburn. And we went out. Where would we go? We went out to the Mustang Lake Road. And we started driving down the road. And I put on the brakes. And I says, now, Mary, I was about 14 and then, I guess, 15. I said, Mary, now I'm going to get out. I'm going around. And I want you to come around to the driver's seat. And you get in the car. And you drive this car. Well, Mary at that time was in her 60s, probably. Had never driven a car. And she got in the car before I could even get back around and get, she mashed on the accelerator. She went flying off down the hill into a deep ditch. And we had to call the prior company wrecker service to come and pick us up and bring us out of the ditch. She never learned to drive a car after that. But there was a funny drink. Now, some of y'all are way, way too young to remember this, but Colonel LeBlanc from Louisiana invented a medicine, and it would cure anything and everything. And it was called Hadacol. You remember Hadacol? Remember Hadacol? My dad thought Hadacol was the answer to everything. He said, we don't even have to go to the doctor anymore, just drink Hadacol. My dad would buy Hadacol. Art Monroe remembers it because Louisiana wasn't, he used to drink Hadacol all the time. And Art, I'll never will forget it. My dad, he would buy a Hadacol by the, not the bottle, but the case. And one day we came in and we noticed that Mary was feeling very, very good one day. Very good. And she was kind of dancing a jig there, cooking breakfast for us one morning. And we looked over there in the corner and Mary consumed a whole carton of Hadacol, a whole case of it. And those are just wonderful things about Mary. But boy, she was an influence on our life. And I think about Mary so much all the time. And she was very, very special. And she and my mother had this wonderful, special relationship. They really did. And Mary had a special relationship. We built on the lake house, we built a special room for Mary, a porch. And wherever we would go, if it was to South Carolina, we would take for vacations, Mary would go with us, and Hot Springs, she would go with us, and to the lake, she would always go with us, but she never did drive a car.
So were there any other sayings that she had, like, if a turtle ever bites you, he won't let go until it thunders?
There were probably some, but I can't recall any right now. Paul, Eleanor, can you remember any? Okay. Barbara and I got married about the time Mary was phasing out, and so I doubt if Barbara would remember any either, but she really had a strong impact on our life. She was a part of our family, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So you say in your story that you've returned to Mustang Lake only once or twice, and after a massive South Arkansas tornado ripped up many of the ancient majestic cypress trees. So what was that like for you returning?
Well, some of the lake houses that once again had been built on stilts, most of them 8 feet high, some of those houses had just, it had made splinters of them. This tornado was vicious. It was a tough one. It came right down the lake and just took both sides of the lake. Many, many of the old cypress trees and other trees out of the, off the sides. The McDonald's had a home that was not destroyed. The Watts's had a home that was destroyed. They owned the local hardware store. Hoyt McLeod, he sold insurance, and he and Ms. McLeod would get out every afternoon in the canoe, and you could see him out there. It looked like he was singing the Indian love call to him. They were in their 80s, you know, and they were paddling along. But anyway, it was just a quaint little place. And then right down the was the Fred Walker who baited his dock illegally, probably, with hay under the dock. I'm not sure about that. Down the lake a little further on the other side was the Rothert family. Many of you grew up with knew the Rotherts and so forth. The Camden Furniture Company. The Walter Hussman home was down the lake just a little bit. Walter Hussman was from Camden, and he has not always lived in Little Rock. I want you to know that. He lived in Camden, and Barbara and I were his teachers at the Presbyterian Church in the Sunday school. Anyway, he lived in Camden, and we grew up with Walter, and I'm a lot older than Walter Hussman, and he's a lot richer than I am. I even started a newspaper in my hometown, Barbara and I did, when we were married. And we had determined that we were going to put Walter Hussman out of business, you know. He put us out of business. You know? But he was a good competitor and a fair competitor, I must say. The Camden News, ours was he had the daily, we had the weekly. And we did that for 4 years before I went back to law school and before Barbara and I moved back to Fayetteville for a 3-year stint. And I was in the legislature at the same time. Any of you, by the way, who are thinking about going to law school and being in the legislature at the same time, don't do it. You won't do either one of them justice, I can tell you that. But that's the way our career path was. And Barbara was a wonderful support system for us, and she worked at the drugstore there while I went to law school and served in the legislature down in Little Rock.
All right, well, we have a few minutes left here for questions, audience questions, and so you can ask Senator Pryor anything you'd like.
Would you tell us the story about Wilbur Botts?
Judge Vlines will appreciate this, because Judge Vlines has to appoint people to boards and commissions and jobs and whatever. And when I was elected governor in 1974 and took over in 75, early January I'd been sworn in. I was feeling pretty good about myself. And I was there in the governor's office one morning, have a morning cigar, and had the fireplace roaring over there on the side. And Knock came on the door, and here came Senator Knox Nelson and Representative Wayne Hampton, some of the senior stalwarts in the legislature, head of the appropriations committees and other committees. And they said, Governor, and there was a man with them following along, they said, we want to introduce you to one of our constituents, Mr. Wilbur Botts of DeWitt, Arkansas. Hello, Mr. Botts. Says, Governor Pryor, Mr. Botts wants to be a part of your administration. And we don't know what y'all have in mind or what you might think about, but we're going to leave the room and let y'all just talk it out and see if there might be some arrangement, some accommodation that can be reached. Well, that was a lot of pressure. And so I said, well, okay. So they left, and I looked at Mr. Botts, and he looked at me. He was a fine lawyer over there and kind of a entrepreneur. He owned a little manufacturing company. He was kind of the town guru, I guess you would say, in DeWitt, Arkansas, and Arkansas County. And Wayne Hampton and Knox had told me in advance that Mr. Hampton had given me $500 and had carried that into the county for me in the governor's race. And as a result, you don't say you owe him an obligation, but it goes without saying. You know, it's just kind of unspoken language, I guess, between politicians. I said, well, Mr. Botts, what is it that you might be interested in? Would you be interested perhaps in education? I didn't see much of a response. Prison reform? No. What about an interest maybe in game and fish issues? Not really. I said, well, Mr. Boss, what is it that, what kind of job would you like in our administration? He said, Governor, tell you the truth, it doesn't make a big difference as long as I can get out of DeWitt at least one night a week. That's all. I told that one night, not 4 or 5 years ago at the DeWitt Chamber of Commerce, and they all got a kick out of it because they all knew Wilbur. Hey, Doc, yeah.
Senator and former governor, would you like to make any choice comments about any of your successors in the governor's office in Arkansas?
I can't remember any of them, unless it's... A little historic perspective. I was fortunate to follow one of the greatest governors we ever had, Dale Bumpers. I was fortunate to be right before one of our greatest governors and then one of our very, very greatest presidents we've ever had, and that, of course, is Bill Clinton. So I was right there between them. And I tell you, from each governor, you learn something. You see things that they do, and you say, well, I wish I had thought about that, or I wish I had done that, or maybe they shouldn't have done it that way, or whatever. But we all, that's our nature, I think. If you're followed in a good job or something, whoever follows along after you, you're probably judging that person a little bit. But I have nothing but respect for the governor that I came after and before, I can tell you that. I did, will tell you this little story, that when we left the governor's mansion and the Clintons were moving in the next day, I went down to the drugstore and I bought a big, big bottle of Tylenol. And I got some big, big tape, and I taped it to the medicine cabinet upstairs, the mirror. And I said, dear Bill, you're going to need this. by the way, I hope y'all all got to see his speech at the Democrat convention. It was unbelievable. Whether you are a Democrat or a Republican or whatever, that truly was one of the great speeches, I think. One of the greatest speeches, and I tell this all the time on him in public, private, whatever, one of the greatest speeches was when he was called back into service during the impeachment trial. Barbara and I had just literally that day returning from a trip to Europe. We got into our home in Little Rock, turn on the TV, and Dale Bumpers had been asked to come and make the closing speech in the impeachment trial of Bill Clinton in the United States Senate. Dale Bumpers had been asked to come back. He'd been out of the Senate about 2 weeks or 3 weeks, and he came back, and I think he delivered one of the finest speeches ever delivered in the Senate chamber. And that night I tried to call him. His line was busy and line was busy and line. Finally, about 10 o'clock our time, 11 o'clock his time, I finally got through to his home in Bethesda. And I said, Dale, I truly believe that that may have been this afternoon, perhaps one of the very finest speeches ever given on the floor of the United States Senate. He says, I'm inclined to agree with you. Good night, y'all.
I was kind of wondering, since I'm sure you probably still have this house on the lake and you want to bring your grandchildren there, if you have any interesting stories that you can tell us to embarrass Mark about.
Oh, a lot of them, yeah. You know, we sold our home. I think we sold it for $700 or something to a local plumber. And he moved out to the lake and lived full time in that great old lake house. And I want to go back there someday and see it. And I think he still lives there, if I'm not mistaken. But yeah, I could tell you some stories about Mark, but why don't we do that in a year or so? We'll do that.
So how about our story and storyteller tonight? Thank you so much, Senator David Pryor, for being on our Tin Roof Project here on Tales from the South. More information can be found out about Senator Pryor and the Pryor Center at pryorcenter.uark.edu. And his book, A Pryor Commitment, can be found at the Butler Center for Arkansas Studies at butlercenter.org. Thank you to our live audience, and thank you to UALR Public Radio. Tales from the South is presented by the Argenta Arts Foundation and Temenos Publishing Company, and our official media sponsor is AY Magazine, Arkansas's leading lifestyle publication at aymag.com. Tonight's show is sponsored by William F. Lehman Public Library, with additional support provided by the North Little Rock Visitors Bureau, the Writers Colony at Derry Hollow, and the Oxford American, the Southern Magazine of Good Writing. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Stitcher, and you can download and listen to our podcast on our website. More can be found at talesfromthesouth.com. Have a great night, and we'll see you next week at Starving Artist Cafe in the Argenta Arts District of North Little Rock, Arkansas, for another edition of Tales from the South. Good night, everybody.
Writer accommodations provided by Robin Wood Bed and Breakfast. Studio time by Infrared Studio Productions. Graphics by Robin Steves at Studio B. Our executive producer and host is Paula Morrell. Our production engineer is Jay Jones. Thanks for helping keep the art of Southern style storytelling alive. And we'll see you next week, either on this station or at Starving Artist Cafe, for another edition of Tales from the South.